Hello, hello and welcome on The Barricades. This is a podcast produced by Eastern European journalists and academics, but this edition is special because it is co-produced with TheAnalysis.com. And this is your host, Maria Cernat, and with me as usual, the Bulgarian-born Polish journalist, Bojan Stanislavski. Thank you for being here with us.
Hello, hello. TheAnalysis.news.
Not .com. TheAnalysis.news. We thank for Jay and this journalistic initiative for offering us the chance to talk to and speak to their viewers and offer our perspectives on recent events taking place not only in Eastern Europe, but in a part of the world that doesn't receive much of the Western media attention. And this time around, we are going to talk about Kazakhstan. Big country situated, as we discussed in the first episode that you will have a link to that we invite you to watch, in Central Asia, along with other republics, that was recently in the middle of some protests, violent protests that erupted in many cities at the beginning of the month. January the 2nd was the day that the protests started in many cities of Kazakhstan, because the prices for natural liquid gas, mainly a fuel used by the citizens in Kazakhstan to move around for their cars mainly, nearly doubled. And that prompted the citizens to go on the streets and protest. Now, on January the 3rd, what is interesting is that the government that is currently ruled by Kasym Yomart Tokayev took a step back and said, okay, we'll listen to you. We understand that maybe the prices are too big. They even started an investigation claiming that it was some sort of cartel, not the government that decided to double the prices. But the very next day, there were all sorts of violent clashes between violent protesters and the security forces. 12 people were killed and 3,000 people were arrested in the days that followed January the 4th. And that was the start of the violent part, so to speak, the violent episode of the protests in Kazakhstan. Now, why is this Kazakhstan important? Because we are talking about a very, very rich country, not only in terms of oil and gas, but also uranium and other important resources that are being exploited with the aid of foreign investment. And we discussed in the first segment of our show the fact that basically the lion's share in terms of foreign investment is taken by Netherlands, Dutch Shell. And then we have in the second position, the United States, and then
Chevron, mostly.
Chevron, of course, and then we have Switzerland, and then we have Russia owning only 6% in terms of foreign investment, and China with 6%, even though Russia has thousands of border, common border with Kazakhstan, they only have 6% in terms of foreign investment in this country. So this is very interesting to see how things unfold also from an economic perspective. It was our pleasure to listen to the analysis provided by my colleague Bojan that showed how complicated basically the power structure in this post-Soviet state actually is, and how many layers of powers have to be taken into account when discussing the situation in Kazakhstan. Now, what happened recently also were the violent clashes stopped when Russia sent a couple of thousands of men on the ground to secure the strategic objectives of the country and to defend its infrastructure and all the rest. Why did they do that? Because Kazakhstan is part of the Collective Security Treaty that was signed in 1992, where Soviet states, post-Soviet states, signed this. Russia, Armenia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, signed actually this treaty. And it's important to note that also China is a observer member of this treaty. So this is a security treaty that basically enabled Russia and allowed for the Russian Federation to intervene and help President Tokayev basically reestablish order in the country. Now, I want to discuss in this segment of our show the media reactions and how this was portrayed. Because as we saw in the first episode, the situation is very, very complex. You have all sorts of informal organizations there, some sorts of clans that are taking an important part in the power structure. You also had this leader that was Nazarbayev, Nursultan Nazarbayev, that was able to maintain some sort of,
he was able some to kind of balance, maybe. Some kind of balance
between all
very volatile. Yeah.
Very volatile situation. Now, he is 81 years old. He is still exercising a lot of influence because he is the head of the Security Council.
He was removed.
He was removed recently, but from that position, he was able to influence the situation in the country. Maybe that was the time where President Kasym Tokayev took the opportunity to assert himself as the main leader, even though Tokayev was actually suggested by Nazarbayev, he was supported by the
It would have not happened otherwise. It's just because of the structure, because of all those things that I explained in the previous segment, because of those dependencies and sort of difficult networks of power and dependencies and so on and so forth, it was almost impossible, or maybe through some violent, coup and stuff like that. But otherwise, like within the political process, whatever we think about the political process and its quality in Kazakhstan, within that framework, it would have been impossible to actually get someone who's obviously hostile, to the top. So this was a gradual process of removing this annoying personality. And I did explain why he appeared annoying, Nursultan Nazarbayev, to many parties that are involved somehow in this Kazakh chessboard. But, the question of Tokayev, and again, I don't have the time to explain his entire biography and stuff like that, but suffice to say that he's a person who is an extremely... who has a lot of experience, okay? Like he's an able bureaucrat with a lot of experience, with a huge past history as a seasoned diplomat. He was in China, he was in Singapore, then he was back in China, even during the Soviet, again, I don't want to even go there because it's a whole different show that we could devote for you. But what is important here, it is important from the point of view of what is going on, what happened last week, basically, this blitzkrieg kind of thing that occurred last week in Kazakhstan, is that, Tokayev is also pretty popular, in this democratic sense, because he was not any sort of central figure, or not even close to central figures, of a slew of corruption scandals that that were just part of the everyday life in Kazakhstan over the past years. So, he is viewed by many as a fair and just and, not corrupt politician. Like, obviously, there is corruption involved, like anywhere on all stages of power in Kazakhstan. So it's kind of difficult for me to believe that he would not participate in any of those schemes that were there to a smaller or bigger extent. But he was basically able to come clean of any sort of, major, big, scandalous, corruption situations that are really a kind of standard thing in Kazakhstani politics, so to say. So that's also pretty important. And obviously, because of his past, because of his abilities as a diplomat and so on and so forth, he's able to speak to foreign factors. He's able to, sit down, negotiate with Russia, with China, with whomever, and who obviously has got a kind of understanding of how to act in difficult situations and so on and so forth. And obviously for him, it was important to sort of be able to assert himself as the leader and to finally, you know, get rid of Nursultan Nazarbayev, okay, as the head of the Security Council. Because what is important, one of the important features of being the head of the Security Council in Kazakhstan is that all the security apparatus, which is the repressive apparatus of the state, is in the hands of that person. So, you know, generally speaking, Tokayev was allowed to become sort of, you know, to dictate the dynamics of the internal process in Kazakhstan by becoming the president of the country. But he was not, you know, able to do whatever he likes because he would be easily stopped had he crossed, you know, somewhere the interests of the group of the oligarchic clan group backing Nursultan Nazarbayev, who at the time, you know, had been the head of the Security Council. I'm sorry for the confusion if it appears confusing to anyone, but this is the situation. It's just pretty complicated.
So let me sum it up. So basically you had two key figures in the power structure, the official power structure, because as Boyan explained, there are all sorts of informal groups that are very important in Kazakhstan because this is the structure of the society. It is somehow clan-based, very hierarchical, with a lot of informal leaders. But formally, there are two important functions, and that is the president and the head of the security apparatus.
That's right.
Now, it was a very long and painful process to get rid of Nursultan Nazarbayev, who asserted himself for a while as a balanced leader, but at a certain point he became narcissistic to the point of insanity, moving the capital and then renaming it. Now the capital is Nursultan. I find this to be extremely hilarious, but nevertheless. And then the way to do it was to somehow convince him to give up the position of president and to go and become the leader of the Security Council. And he would still exert a lot of power from that position. And the most plausible explanation right now is that basically Tokayev wanted to use these protests to get rid of Nazarbayev once and for all, and to remove him even from the Security Council and to assert himself as the leader and the true leader of Kazakhstan. That would be plausible. And I think he succeeded because also he dismissed all the members of the government and formed a new government. And he announced, I think, just the other day or very recently, he announced that the government will be headed by a bureaucrat and a technocrat. So things are going to the direction that was anticipated, and that is that between the clash between the two, Tokayev and Nazarbayev, Tokayev won the battle. And now it is finally the time for Nazarbayev at 81 years old to retire, isn't it?
To retire, that's true, that's high time, absolutely. But I don't know, you know, he impersonates this kind of Soviet tradition of gerontocracy, like, you know, Brezhnev died in power. I don't know, maybe Nursultan Nazarbayev had the same plans, I'm not sure. But you know, what is important here is definitely to look at it as, you know, power war, power game between those two people. And it's a factor that is often overlooked. But I think we should perhaps begin with how it all began and what it transformed itself to. And only then, how would Kasym Jomart Tokayev actually benefit from it? And of course, you know, in the whole story, what I'm presenting here is a hypothetical explanation because on the basis of very careful, I would argue, research that I that I've done. But let's go back to the 2nd of January, okay, which is when it all indeed began. And, you know, the beginning was pretty symbolic, I would say, because it began in the town or city of Zhanozen, okay, which is also, I mean, people who followed or who have followed the situation in Kazakhstan or Central Asia would probably recall the situation in Zhanozen and the province. It's in the west, where the resources are, where the companies are that, you know, the direct foreign investments and all the rest of it, and where the junior Jews is also sort of located in this area. It started there, and it started, there was a logical reason why it started there. Because all those companies, including the refineries that sort of refined the gas or the oil, the everything, and then, you know, make it available to gas stations, retailers, and so on and so forth, they are there. And indeed, what happened, was in terms of the policy of the government that produced this crisis, was that the government removed the cap from the price. In other words, it removed the control of the price of the LNG, which is liquid natural gas, which serves as the main fuel for individual people and for businesses in Kazakhstan, mostly because it's very cheap and because there's abundance of it in Kazakhstan. And apparently cars mm-hmm. can run on that too. I'm not a driver, so I don't know about this technology. But it's most of the cars, they don't drive on gasoline, but they drive on LNG. Now, we have to be aware of the fact that the LNG price per liter was extremely low. And also the taxes that are, normally in Europe, at least, I don't know about, America and Canada, but in Europe, at least, there are many taxes attached to every liter of oil or gasoline that you're purchasing, because those taxes then serve the purpose of construction, road construction, renovation of those roads and the transportation infrastructure and so on and so forth. Well, this is not precisely the case in Kazakhstan. I mean, there are some taxes attached there, but they are very low, particularly in comparison to, the countries of Europe. So the price was about 50, 60 tenge, which is the currency in Kazakhstan, and it does correspond to about 0.1, that is 10 euro cents, okay, per liter of LNG gas. So we're talking about very low prices, very low. And because some people would probably, ask the question whether, it could be compared nominally, that we should have we should compare it also considering the average wage maybe, or some other indicators like that. So let me just say, for the purpose of the discussion, that the average wage, which I know is not the perfect indicator, but let's just take it here. The average wage in Kazakhstan is is just 50% of the average wage in Poland. So we're talking about 500 euros and 1,000 euros, okay, roughly. I mean, 500 euros being the average wage in Kazakhstan and 1,000 euros being the average wage in Poland. Again, roughly. So, 1.1, like 10 euro cents per liter, regardless of whether you earn 500 euros or 1,000 euros, I mean, of course it matters, but regardless of that, is very little for 1 liter of fuel, okay? Very little. So whether it's 1.1, 0.2, it's not really such a major issue, but it was enough, and I accept this, that it sort of brought people out to the street to protest, because it was, regardless of how little the sums are, it's, 100% increase, okay? So people have all the reasons in the world to go out and be dissatisfied with it, and they started a protest. Now, what happened? And this is something that is overlooked or not reported or unreported in the Western media, is that on the second day, when the protests were gaining traction, but they were absolutely peaceful, classical protests, so to say, people would gather some, in front of certain facilities. Institutions, facilities would block the roads, maybe, some intersections and stuff like that. What happened on the second day of the protest, which is on the, some sources argue that it even happened in the first day, but like for the sake of the discussion, the second day, the local authorities in Zhanaozen and the management of the biggest refineries there, they went out to the protesters and they said they don't understand what is going on. They really, that's at least what's reported in the media, Kazakhstani media and Russian media, that they are not sure what was going on, because they did sell They did sell at a higher level after the cap was removed, but not such high. They reported that they were selling their LNG for about 75 tenge per liter, and there is just makes no sense for it to be available to retailers for 120, which it was the situation, okay? That it's just that this mechanism is very strange. And this is why the prosecution in Kazakhstan is actually looking into a potential business mm-hmm. conspiracy, okay? Because obviously, and I find this credible, that, you know, the no one knew why is this really so high. Now, anyway, right after this, the initial protests, on the second and on the third, actually the government made a pledge that they're going to reintroduce some kind of control mechanism on the prices of LNG. Not the same one, probably, maybe something else. They were not sure yet, but one way or another, this problem would be solved. So they wouldn't have to be really preoccupied with that. You know, in a situation like that, what you would expect is, you know, the protesters to go out, declare victory, I don't know, go party, go home, whatever, you know, and wait for the results, in a sense that, you know, in a 1 week time or whatever, they would sort of see whether the government had actually delivered on the promises or not. So, but the strange thing that occurred, and this is where, you know, the color revolution scenario seems to kick in, and it seems to be credible, at least to some extent. Now, I want to say that straightforward. There is no clear evidence that there was a color revolution attempt, at least not in the most classical manner that we would have, that could be easily compared to Ukraine or Belarus. That's true, but there were some elements which were definitely part of the handbook. You know, I mean, I don't know who wrote that textbook on color rail, how to carry them out, but you know, it's just one book, and it seems like it's an instruction that is applied here and there every once in a while. So what happened is, on the protest suddenly started to gain very violent character, and in a region which is completely, you know, somewhere totally away, like, you know, from the country's west, where they originally began and where it was logical for them to actually begin. And, of course, in that region, there were also some other demonstrations. But again, this is a factor overlooked by the Western journalists, because they focus on, you know, in Almaty, there were thousands of people. That's true. There were thousands of people. But in many other small towns, there were demonstrations or meetings, you know, sometimes a few hundred people, and sometimes just a dozen of people would go out in a very meaningless manner. Like, why would they actually do this? You know, why would 12 or 10 or 15 or some, you know, some such an amount of people go out, you know, in you know, in the main squares of the town?
I think we lost Boyan for a while here, and while waiting for him. Yes, I am here.
Oh, okay, sorry.
I was saying that we lost you for a few seconds, and that was a perfect opportunity for me to announce again the viewers that we are discussing the way it was presented in the media. And as you said in the previous segment, of course, what could you expect, since the West has every interest to bash Russia, and now it is the blue protesters in quest for democracy that are being crushed by the ugly and cruel dictator, and so on and so forth. This is a narrative, and of course, Russia, the biggest wolf of all the way, the biggest enemy, is going to go there and crush the protesters. And then you had the Russian media that you explained that they were screaming, oh, CIA, this is orchestrated from outside the country, and so on and so forth. While in fact, it started off in a very volatile internal political landscape. Here we had Nazarbayev and Tokayev somehow competing. You had the president Tokayev and Nazarbayev, the head of the security, that were in a rivalry, actually, because Tokayev didn't want it to be just a poodle of Nazarbayev and wanted to assert himself as a true leader and not just some sort of minor figure that would just do as the old Nazarbayev would tell him to do. And now you had this very interesting thing that happened on January 4th when the demands of the protesters were met and
essentially, yes.
And then it started to become violent. Then it started to become violent.
Right.
This is very interesting. And you said that, of course, this is not the situation like the one in Ukraine, but at the same time, you see some very peculiar things, like the fact that basically the so-called revolt or revolution started in one part of the country, then it
became then it suddenly
violent.
Went somewhere else. Yeah, in a very coordinated manner. In a very that's you know what gives me the kind of sense that there must have been some kind of color revolution element in the whole initiative, because this is the basis for all color revolutions. The most important things are to create chaos and violence in the very beginning in order to create the kind of impression that would be followed by all kinds of propaganda in the social media and everywhere that the authorities are giving up. Because this is the only way that you can break the morale of the security apparatus, like the police, the army, the whatever, the gendarmerie, whatever is, in whatever state. So this is exactly what they were trying to do. And, and this is the crucial moment for all color revolutions, is whether the authorities are strong enough to sort of react against that in a forceful manner. And this is pretty strange, because like in Kazakhstan, in Almaty, in Nur-Sultan, which are cities and urban centers far, far away from where the protests initially erupted, and that it happened in a very organized manner, particularly in the afternoon and in the evening, and then the riots would last through the whole night, right? And that's not how it happens. Like, if it's spontaneous, you don't have the same thing going on in the same manner in different spots, which are far away from where the protests originated. And again, it might be a coincidence. I don't know. Like, there is no evidence that someone actually pulled the strings and let them out, but there is a convincing circumstantial evidence. Convincing, at least to me, that on the one hand, it was the opposition in or the Kazakhstani opposition. I was going to say in Kazakhstan, but many of them are not in Kazakhstan. Mm-hmm. The opposition leaders, and I'm not going to talk about them and even give the names, because it doesn't matter. I would have to tell the whole story around them. But one of them is in exile, who's a gangster who was convicted of corruption in Kazakhstan, in exile in Paris. There are two people that run a platform, an opposition platform called Base, that are apparently a marriage. I even wrote down their names. It's like Aidos and Natalia Sadikov. Okay, so they run this. And all of the opposition, suddenly they wanted by the way, about those Sadikovs, even their phone numbers, okay, when you look at their official platform, their website, they are Ukrainian phone numbers. So, it also speaks, right, to the whole situation and to how the thing, how the opposition functions there. But, and by the way, this is why some people have picked up this train of thought, this train of analysis, to link the violence and the clashes with some kind of incentive coming from Ukraine, okay? It's because those leaders, those opposition leaders that are already residing in Ukraine or other or Paris or wherever, mm-hmm. they were trying to project their alleged influence onto those protests, and they were doing their best to present it as their initiative. So it's not so much of a mistake on the part of many journalists that were sort of they kind of reported on this, that some people obviously reported to some journalists that it's them who are leading the revolt, despite the fact that it was not the case. And the journalists, because of the location of those figures, sort of making the association or making the conclusion that the protests are managed from Ukraine. Anyway, so those people were doing their best. And when they were doing their best, I believe that it could have been the case that the West okay, and the usual suspects that are everywhere, all over the place, like, you know, the human rights lobby, democracy spreading lobby, whatever, you know, those NGOs, the civic society, so to say, that they kind of picked up on that. And, you know, some Westerners, probably some sections of the Western ruling classes thought that, well, maybe it's a good moment actually to do something. And, you know, in case like, you know, in Kazakhstan, they, you know, it was enough to just drop the bomb of chaos and let's see what comes out of it for them, because otherwise they had not much of a move, right? So perhaps some sections of the ruling of Western ruling classes thought that it would be okay for them to actually use this opportunity to see how prepared the opposition in Kazakhstan is to actually take part in an experiment like a color revolution. So I don't think that they believed that they could actually take power. I don't believe that, because it was obvious to anyone, even to the most thick-headed, you know, democracy spreading, you know, neocons wherever in America or elsewhere, that, you know, the Kazakhstani opposition is way, way too weak to, you know, perform an exercise like the one we observed in Ukraine or Belarus. But I think that they did try to do something. Now, it's actually the media that were encouraging them to do that, in my opinion, because they were falsely reporting that the clashes are ongoing, that the police is giving up, that the police is switching sides even, which seems to be a total BS. On the contrary, according to all reports, which I find very credible and detailed and informed, mm-hmm. that I read, mm-hmm. During the night, before midnight, I think it was even, or maybe shortly after midnight, from the 4th and the 5th of January, the police in Almaty was able to push back, you know, on the protesters, to remove them from all the buildings that they managed to set on fire, occupy, destroy, and stuff like that. They managed to move them from the central squares, and they started a large-scale repression in terms of detentions, arrests, and so on and so forth. So the scene was rather clean, you know, in that moment.
This is interesting. Yes, exactly. Because, of course, in Romania... Yes, please finish your thought, because I have my own take.
No, please go way in. I will finish the story later.
There are some important elements that I want to make sure that I convey to our public, both the Barricade and the analysis.news. Now, first of all, there is a lot of hypocrisy going on here. And if the mainstream media presents you with narratives where you have positive and negative heroes, stay away from it. Just stay away from it, because this is far too complicated. And I think a person that has a pinch of intelligence should stay away from such narratives. I would give you just this. Please, Bojan, show us a very beautiful family picture where you will see this person, Nur Sultan, this dictator that renamed the capital of Kazakhstan after his name. It is now Nur Sultan. It was Astana, but it is now Nur Sultan. So he is in the same picture in the Guardian article that was presented recently with, voila, Tony Blair. This is so interesting, isn't it? And why is this interesting? Because in 2011, that was an uprising in Kazakhstan that was repressed. But back then, there were not beautiful people fighting with the dictator, isn't it? There were violent elements that needed to be repressed. And 30 million euros later, because this is the estimate of how much the company ran by Tony Blair received from Nazarbayev. So 30 million dollars later, then we see that Kazakhstan is a model of success, of democracy, and so on and so forth. And I wanted to make sure that the viewers consume this. So I want to just show again, because I like very much the family picture where you can see this is Nur Sultan Nazarbayev and Tony Blair, just to be sure and to understand that presenting black and white perspective.
Maria, I'm sorry, I'm just realizing now that this article was written by Luke Harding. You can see his name on the right side, or maybe on the left side, depending on you know the screen. But Luke Harding is the most pathetic journalist of The Guardian. I mean, he is the guy who wrote the book Collusion, and who was dismantled many times on real journalism programs, not least in the one led by Aaron Mate. At the time when he was still in the Real News Network, where he just, you know, ran away from the studio. I mean, he just switched himself off while they were talking because he was just not. I'm sorry. I just had to weigh in because when I saw this name, I'm just allergic to Luke Harding. But anyway, that's just a.
Anyway, we can find different articles because this is. I mean, yeah. I mean, I just picked up because I like the picture, but this is common sense, actually. The fact that this is why I also showed the map with the foreign investment. I mean, look at the numbers and follow the money. The idea that you suddenly have some people that are so thirsty for freedom, fighting dictators, this is such BS. I mean, people should move on because this type of narratives made it possible for right-wingers to take power. Now, the second thing that I want to say here, of course, the Russians are going to say, this is the CIA and this is the foreign... You know, when people are upset, you cannot infantilize them and say, this is the workings of the CIA. Yes, of course it is, but they have to find a fertile ground. If there is not the fertile ground, then people are perfectly happy with the lives that they are living, then...
Color revolutions don't occur where people are, you know,
where people are happy with their lives,
are thriving.
So it is no point in infantilizing and emphasizing all the on foreign interference because it means that all Kazakhstani citizens are just children, isn't it? Are so naive and easy to be led. An important factor that I wanted to let our viewers know.
What is also pretty important here, probably, is sort of the Russians or the Russian propaganda, if you like, or I don't know, the Russian media, they when they were presenting their narrative, they were not really trying to infantilize people. I mean, the Russian propaganda, whatever the Russian reporting on that matters is much more intelligent. What they are saying is that people that are subjected to this kind of experiment or this kind of operation, like color revolutions, that they are being the victim of it. It's not that they are being led by the nose by someone. It's normally this interpretation is by and large true. I mean, this is not the regular people that go somewhere and that they're being led by the nose because they are stupid and ignorant that they can't understand. It's mostly color revolutions are prepared and conducted and exercised and led by, and there could be some people who are confused, obviously, taking part in it, but it's not the main thing. They are led by highly trained, organizers. Okay, that means people groomed by all those NGOs and other nefarious organizations that are just there to meddle in the political process of countries where the authorities are disliked by the West. So what I want to say here is that they were not trying to say that Kazakhstani people are stupid or anything like that. They were just arguing in a very bold manner, which kind of there is no evidence for it in this instance, but they were arguing in a very bold manner. Oh, the CIA, and the West and trying to organize the coups and stuff like that, and so I think that this was a little bit over the top, but I also want to say that there is an element of truth
you know what caught my attention was the fact that it was so organized and so harmonious and so violent at the same time. This is not how ordinary people organize. I mean,
exactly.
And we should see common elements. They go for what? National television. They go for strategic objectives. This is what they call them. They organize in a very violent manner. Everything happens very fast. Then they have the media propaganda sending all sorts of reports all over the place that it is a clear victory on their side. So all these elements here are to be taken into account when discussing these episodes, because I don't imagine ordinary people knowing that they have to go there and to be so well organized. I mean, we don't have evidence for that, but this is important to know.
You're right. Here. You're right. But also, people have to, you know, people just protests. When you see, you know, I participated in many protests and many actions and many also, things like that. You too, right? Yes. Like, exactly. And you know what happens with protests, street protests and stuff like that? Okay, you can have some occupation here and there. You can have a blockage of I don't know, intersections or whatever. But finally, you know, after some time,
you go home.
You either have to, yeah, exactly. You go home because you got to go to work, you got to go to school, you got to do all those kind of things. You got to cook for your children, you know, you got to spend time with your family. And when people just don't go home and stay there and spark violence and you know, those kind of things happen, then you start to wonder, right? So this is a classical case. I mean, Kazakhstan, like, instead of going home, especially after they've achieved their goals,
yes,
right? I mean, the government said, okay, guys, go home. We're going to take care of it. No worries.
And, you know, about the internet, the thing that I want to...
I'm going to get to that.
They closed down the internet, and yes,
why?
Of course.
But this is a very important question.
Yes, well, here, the only thing that I want to say, there's a lot of information that this is interesting. Kazakhstan saw an 8% increase in terms of energy consumption because China cracked down on Bitcoin mining companies. 88 companies had to flee China because mining for Bitcoin was forbidden there. Why? Because it's a huge pressure on the energy grid of these companies that had to do huge calculations and have their computers doing this mining operations for Bitcoin. And I had instances, and we heard of instances of actually Chinese authorities going down and destroying the computers because these people wouldn't listen otherwise. So they had to go somewhere. Where to go? 88 companies. That's a huge number for 80 million people country like Kazakhstan to go there because energy was very cheap, and they placed a very important burden on the energy grid and on energy consumption. And I think this is also
That's
important.
True.
And I think it was a good thing that they closed down the internet because everybody was desperate. I know that I have friends working in IT and everybody's fascinated with all this libertarian Bitcoin speculation.
Yeah,
and they were desperate because the Bitcoin went down because of that. So.
But by the way, if you allow, I feel that we should actually conclude this episode now and start a third segment because we're running out of time very rapidly. I can see that there's like about 2 minutes and a half until the end of that segment. I just want to say for the very end of this segment is that you're totally right to interpret it, in my opinion, the kind of Bitcoin thing in this context. I only want to say that, you know, I feel, judging by, you know, the amount or the intensity of the attachment of the Western media to this Bitcoin thing, I think it's a bit overblown in the sense that, you know, I mean, there were elements which were much more important than the Bitcoin thing in the entire event. But let me just get to that in the third segment of our program.
Okay, that will be a short one. So thank you very much for watching. Thank you, Paul J. and the analysis.news for allowing us to talk to your audience. Thanks you, our viewers. So I hope you find this information that we present here interesting. And if you do, please go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/thebarricade. Become our Patreon and support us. And we'll see you all in our next segment. Thank you, Boyan, for the analysis and dialogue.
Thank you.